And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street, singing songs and a carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. We better stop now, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. We better stop.
Well, Patty Quatro, we ended the last episode on such a cliffhanger, thanks to you and your teasing us about the pleasure seekers and the next moves to mix things up again, even after your sister Nancy Quatro joining. And you ended with a very teasing question, what's next?
Oh my God. Well, what can I say? My band leader role has now taken the front, and I am fully on focused on that and percolating as I wonder the things that I'm going to have to change and mix up, whatever I can do with all the things that you've mentioned. I mean, so many changes. So what now, next? Right.
What next is right. And also kudos to you, because your instincts about bringing your kid sister, Nancy Quatro, into the Pleasure Seekers was absolutely spot on, because they added an element and a more rockier sound to the band. This is not to discount anybody. Your playing, though, also started to really get heavier, and you can hear your lead, no pun intended, but you were taking the lead on your guitar and really, really owning it. And just on an aside, my dear, my friend, my podcast partner in fun, as we like to say, as many know, I also do the marketing for this podcast. And we have now done, this is our 45th episode for season 3. And I have to tell you that I have never seen such amazing accolades and outpouring of love and astonishment and kudos to you for your playing and Mr. Power and that you wrote those lyrics. People have really responded in a way that I have never seen before. And it's not that people don't love the Pleasure Seekers and they love all your other songs, but this Mr. Power and what you brought to the episode and also to the song has really resonated with your fans, our listeners, old and new fans, and you do have a bunch of new fans now because of them hearing it. So I just wanted you to take that in for a second. So for anybody that wants to read some of these, there were so many, go to our podcast Facebook page and read some of them there, or if it's friends with you, it's right there on your Facebook page. So I just wanted to say that you are beloved, my dear.
Oh God, that is so sweet. That really hits my heart because, as I said on that episode, that was the performance that meant the most to me and that song. And to hear that it resonates with our audience blows my mind. Of course, owing to your expert marketing, you're the marketing genius, but still, to hear all that and read it all, it's oh my, warm and fuzzy to the max.
Warm and fuzzy to the max, and you know I will take credit where credit is due whenever I can. But in this case, it had nothing to do with my marketing. It had to do with people hearing the episode, hearing what you brought to it, and delivering musically. It
Oh.
was not hyperbolic when you read the lyrics, and they are astounding. We'll let people go back and listen again or read them. But also, again, people, I think it's resonated, and it's as I said before, but I think it bears repeating, it is Mr. Power is a song that could be written today and it would be equally as applicable.
It doesn't have a timestamp on it. You're right about that.
It's just beautiful. So I also want to remind the listeners. So at this point, with your sister Nancy Quattro coming on board, you still had Nancy Rogers on drums. So even though all four sisters were now in the band, Nancy Rogers was still bringing a lot, you thought, bandleader Pat. She was playing vibes at this point. She played a horn with one hand and drums with the other. I think you said on the song Spinning Wheel, which I wish I could see live. And you said eventually she played the timpani. And you still had Pammy Benford and her very heavy bird guitar. And so I do have some follow-up questions regarding the other band members. So this is more of a general question. So again, you're all still very young women. No, you're not teenagers anymore per se, although Susie's still a teen technically, but you're very young women and you're experiencing the world as young women for the first time. So even if you're in a rock and roll band, you still have emotions and egos and conflicts just because you're human. So when you, Patty, bandleader Pat, told Susie, your sister Arlene, Nancy Rogers, and Pam Benford that you wanted to bring in Nancy Quattro on vocals, was there any kind of pushback or jealousy, anything from your sister Susie, who had been so revered as the vocalist and the front person? So I'm just curious.
It's interesting you bring up psychology and emotions. It's so true. Four sisters, if you can imagine, and all four of us are such characters in our psyches. We just really are. I have to be honest about that. If Susie was bugged a little, she didn't say anything about it, and she was pretty much the more front focus, even though Arlene sang, I sang songs, and I. And being in my blunt way, I'm such a brat sometimes. I think I said to her, you're over now. We need to bring in a new element. And I'm sure she'll never forget me saying that. And I wasn't saying it mean. I was saying, I was thinking as a band leader, we got to mix it up. We got to do something. We bring Nancy and we're going to have two different kinds of voices. You guys share it back and forth. It'll be incredible. Really mix it up. So that's how I did it. I explained it to her and she may have been a little bit bugged, but she didn't express it. She was okay. It was her sister after all. And she saw the points I was making. All the sisters did. So we just thought it would be a really cool idea and make us heavier because Nancy had a different kind of voice. So it was a great decision. And Nancy really escalated quickly in her vocals, which served us well. So that's what happened.
Well, that's hilarious, but maybe not so much for Susie. And I don't know if I'd want to be on the receiving end of you, bandleader Pat, saying, "You're over. Nobody cares about you anymore."
Oh,
Well,
I think
and as we talked about Mr. Power and the sound that was brought on that, we also listened to Where Have You Gone with Nancy's wailing voice. And we also got a bunch of comments when we listened to it on the previous episode that the blend of Nancy's wailing with Susie's lower voice was just, again, added a whole other element. And like you said, a heavier sound. And so I want to remind the listeners, I mean, for me, I'm saying it because it really bears repeating, that Mr. Power and Where Have You Gone? Today we're going to be listening to White Pig Blues, and on the closing episode, we will be listening to Brain Confusion. And the reason why I'm sharing this is those four songs, these four songs, were recorded on your dad's two-track tape. We had talked about this. We put a pin on it in it with Martin Preece, your new roadie, that he recorded you these four songs on a two-track, and including and or that this might have been recorded on a two-track live. And so I would like you to talk a little bit about this, and because to me what it really highlights is how tight you were live. This, you can't say, well, you were in a studio, Pioneer Records studio, and or Mercury or whatever. Not that anybody would have questioned you on that, but in this case, thank you, two-track recorder by your dad and Martin Preece. We're getting a glimpse into maybe what you sounded live. What do you think? Talk to anything about this and tell us now who Martin Preece was.
Oh, Martin was amazing. He was a guy out of Detroit. I don't know how we found him, but he was building his own business, building amps and stuff. And he knew a lot of technology, you know, how to run stuff and tape. So we had him, and he was sort of in and out because he was still building a business. So we still have Mike Roswell, and Gil was still roadieing for us. So it was
Well,
sort
wait,
of,
time out, because just to
I
tie it
know,
in,
he came back.
Gil Kiper, who we were talking about, became your roadie after he was the Who's roadie when they were in the States, when you first met the Who and Roger Daltrey. Again, we'll put a pin in that story. But Gil Kiper ended up staying on because he's American and wrote being a roadie with all of you a year in 1968. I believe 67 and 68. And then when he and Darlene Arnone, drummer, break up, he leaves. But now Darlene Arnone is gone. Nancy Rogers is in. So Gil Kiper is back as your roadie, kind of on and off. So go on. I just wanted to clarify all the
I
names.
can't even explain. It's like in the Rock Ether. I think we had a few changes of roadies through that time period. We're gigging and things happen, you know. So Gil came back in, and Martin was also helping Alice Cooper, you know. So and so was Mike Roswell. So these roadies sort of floated around sometimes, depending on the gigs. It's odd. But I want to make a very important point as we move forward here, because you just made it. Martin taped all of these songs on our two-track. He came to so many gigs and taped them. And this is like for 4 or 5 years he did this, you know, crossing over from Pleasure Seekers and all the Cradle ones, which will be next season, on a simple two-track machine. I mean, it's unbelievable. So all this music is absolutely lived and saved in a closet for decades and then cleaned up as much as you could for crowd sound by a sound engineer, Jim Fried, later, and Martin. And then they come out way later on Sundays. So it's amazing they survived. It blows my mind. And it does show the lyrics, the tightness of the band. This is live in ballrooms and clubs. It's unbelievable.
It's
Unbelievable.
incredible. Not only is it incredible that it survived, and like you said, it shows how tight you were, but the sound, considering this is a two-track, it's incredible. And so for anybody who either has or is going to purchase the Pleasure Seekers retrospective, which is a CD, again, those four songs were recorded basically on a two-track live by Martin Preece, but they were cleaned up for the CD retrospective years later by your saying Jim Fry. So just to give credit where credit is due.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, go ahead.
It's, you know, this we'll really get into it heavily in our next season, but that whole record was done by Martin. You know, and most of it, a lot of it was done on New Year's Eve with the MC5 at the Grandy, live in that big ballroom. So you really get the feeling. We used to have kids write us on our, we still do, the younger fans, and they say, how did you get that sound back then? And they're, wow, it sounds so alive. That's the thing about live recordings. You can't beat that, you
It's
know?
incredible. It's really incredible. I mean, and again, it takes a talented band to also sound that good on a two track. I mean, that's amazing. Well, since we're speaking of younger people for one second, a young gal that I met who's 24 and she's a Detroiter lifelong, I was showing her some pictures of the Pleasure Seekers. She was asking about what I did, and I told her about what about you and everything. And when I showed her the pictures and then played her "Where Have You Gone," she squealed and said,
Oh my God.
she said, "They look and sound so new."
Oh my
And
God.
I knew exactly what she meant when she said that. It was so cute. And it just shows, again, we will get to the legendary status of the Pleasure Seekers and Cradle, but we're not there yet. We are still, my dear, in August 1969. And again, Nancy Quattro, really just like a fish to water. She's new, but she's now integral to the band. And so on August 7th, 69, you played, I love this name, Club Ponytail, Pleasant View Road in Harbor Springs, Emmett County, still in Michigan. And also on the bill was the Revised Sound. And I'm curious if you remember anything about this gig.
Well, they put in the ad straight from Ed Sullivan or something. I thought, what, where the hell did they get that from? I'm telling you, it cracks me up how many errors are made through decades of people just pasting, cutting and pasting, and it's completely wrong. So I'm thrilled that we're doing the factual history of the
Well,
lifetimes of,
yes, and also I think I hope this lets listeners know that they shouldn't just take everything at face value and to go do their homework because it's important. Now, in this particular case, it made me laugh because, and we have a picture of it. We will post this bill that you did. I believe you're the only one where it says Pleasure Seekers as seen on Ed Sullivan. Now, the funny thing is, this is August 1967, so we didn't have Google. Nobody's going to go back and check out YouTube videos of Ed Sullivan, but this was such a common ploy for club owners and managers and PR people to do this. But it is really funny. And you know what? There's a wonderful Yiddish word, chutzpah, which means balls. That club, the Ponytail Club, that took some chutzpah to say that you had appeared on Ed Sullivan, only the biggest television show on the
I
planet.
know. It cracked me up when I saw it. I couldn't believe it. Talk about gilding the lily a bit. And often they wouldn't have the right picture. They had a picture from a previous gig or something. So it wouldn't be the exact members, the
Oh,
picture
that's funny.
used. It happens all the time.
That's funny. Well, then a week later on August 15th, you play, and I'm really curious about this one. This is August 15th, 69, Kenwick on the Lake, Bright's Grove, and you play with the MC5, the Amboy Dukes, Mitch Ryder, your former brief boyfriend, Mother Lode, Stooges, The Rationals, Fruit of the Loom, Frigid Pink, The T, Whiskey Howl, Big Al's Band, Scarborough Fair, Sound Spectrum, Jackie Graham Society, ooh, and the Pleasure Seekers. Tell us anything you remember about this festival, your set, any anecdotes, anything at all.
One thing I'll say about the festivals that is important to note for this generation and all the decades. We were so open in Michigan and the Midwest to all types of genre, okay? Scarborough Fair on that. I mean, with the MC5, I mean, come on. And every bit of it was enjoyed. I mean, yeah, we were all stoned, but everybody enjoyed the variety. It was such a big deal. It wasn't like packaged, like, oh, only heavy music or only this or that, So we had a wide range. And this was only the second pop festival with Nancy. And we were already, this is the one where we were having fleeting, very back burner thoughts about what else we could do. And it was pretty damn important. We were actually just, in our heads thinking, well, should we change our name? We're going heavier. It was just an idea. We didn't make any plans, but. And my taking more of a lead guitar, all of it came into play very quickly at this festival. And we sort of had a direction brewing in the sisters' minds.
Oh.
Definitely.
Wow. Well, and we mentioned this before on the previous episode, but again, I think it's important to reiterate between Mr. Power and Where Have You Gone, which Nancy was on, Nancy, your sister, Nancy Quattro, already the sound of the Pleasure Seekers was completely different from what it had been. So I understand that there was this possible name change, which also at the time back then, bands did often. They would alter the name, they would change it. SRC, for example, was Scott Richardson Case or Scott Richards Case. So that wasn't that unique. But okay, so at this point though, even with the mulling around a name change, you were at this point still the Pleasure Seekers. This is 1964 as the Pleasure Seekers, all the way up to 69, and you've made huge ground as a pioneer band. And so I have some questions about the name change, but we'll get there. But I guess my main question right now was, because you had been together so long and because you were so popular and because you already had a very large fan base, were you reticent at all changing the name?
Well, that's funny. To be very blunt, me and the band came to feel that doing something different was never going to be a hard-ass deterrent in any regard. If it would serve our band and point us in a new important direction, so no, the Quattro Balls were well in place inside our heads to do as we felt important to do at any given time to meet changing trends. And that's what we did.
Well, again, we're not there yet, but you're thinking about it, which is, again, you're looking forward. You're forward thinking, which I love. You're still very, very determined as the band leader, but also as a band. And so, as you said, this is only the second performance by Nancy. She's really only been in the band for, I don't know, a month. And as we've said, it's all four Quattro sisters are now in the Pleasure Seekers. And so you wanted to mix it up. And so you decided now, before even a name change, that you were going to do a huge, I think this is huge. And let me just pause here and say this again. You, band leader Pat, whether you spoke to the other band members or not, decided to do a huge experimental transition for the Pleasure Seekers. This was September 7th. So again, within weeks, 1969. So tell us what happens.
Okay. Well, first of all, we'll go backwards for a second. Nancy Rogers and Pammy were on the August 15th gig, that pop festival. It was still the Pleasure Seekers, and we were having these feelings, the Kenwick one, and it was Nancy's second gig. And I'm sure it was a bit nostalgic of us knowing it was the last one for Pammy and Nancy, because we had not told them yet, okay?
Oh, wait, hold on. That's news to me. Okay, so you four sisters had already decided while you're playing Kenwick at that pop festival that you were going to basically let Nancy Rogers and Pammy go, but Pammy and Nancy didn't know. Okay, go
they
on.
No, so we had actually about a month to practice quietly in our Quattro garage and see if we could pull it off. That's why we waited telling them. You know, we weren't sure. What a freaking risk that was, changing the whole outlook of the band. And it was a shocker. My God, how many shockers we went through. And we decided to pull it off, and we let them know on September 7th. And Susie was going back on drums. I mean, shock, shock. And she was excited as hell to try it. She had started, you got to remember, she started on bongos with my dad. And then she was pissed that she didn't get to be drums in the Pleasure Seekers because Nan Ball took it. So this was her chance, and she grabbed it. And she just started taking drum lessons. Her teacher was my dad's drummer, and he said she was a natural, which I knew that from, my God, she had that in her. And at the same time, Nancy had been fiddling around with bass. So she picks it up pretty damn quick, and she got some lessons with dad's bass player. You know, my dad was handy that way. You know, he had people that could help us. So Arlene got more equipment, so she had a fabulous heavy organ sound, and we went ahead and started practicing, telling Nancy and Pammy, Nancy Rogers and Pammy, on September 7th that we were disbanding the Pleasure Seekers, going to try something different. Oh, wow.
Okay, so I have a couple of questions to clarify, and this is me either being too literal or a stickler or both. When you say Susie was going to go back on drums, now I just want to clarify that because we talked a lot about this in season two, which was your entire family history and your dad being the music was the family business and he encouraged all of you. So I knew she played bongos and I knew that she wanted to jump on drums after you had your epiphany at 16 of seeing the Beatles and saying, we're going to form a band. But as you said, Nan Ball was already on drums. So when you say Susie was going to go back on drums, you mean go physically back?
Physically to the back. Yeah. She decided to make that change and she was actually excited about it. It's amazing. I mean, I was...
And she clearly had talent. It wasn't that we...
Oh, yeah.
From her teachers and all of that. Okay, and so you said Nancy Quattro starts bass lessons. That's that wonderful picture we shared. We'll share it again of her. She's just such a puppy in that picture. It's adorable. And Arlene starts to get a heavier organ sound and all of that. Now, you just said something, which... So was that a white lie? Was that a lie when you told Pammy Benford and Nancy Rogers that you were disbanding as the Pleasure Seekers? Because you kept the name Pleasure Seekers.
We did keep, we felt it more in the vein that we were disbanding what it had been, you know, that kind of music, that trend with that role, you know, that we wanted to just try something different. I don't know how much explanation we went into, but you got to remember the Quattro girls were well trained by Dad. We had had vocals. We had all had keys. So it was a huge risk, but not so much of a stretch as one might think with the way our family was built around music. So
that makes sense. That makes sense to me. And so then the next logical question would be, what was it like letting Nancy Rogers and Pammy Benford go? Was it hard? And the reason why I ask that, maybe not Nancy Rogers as much because she was newer. She replaced Arlene Arnone.
Right.
And she was relatively new, but Pammy Benford had been on board for a while, back pains or not. She had been a big part of the Pleasure Seekers on tours in the Pacific Northwest and so much more. So what was that scene like?
It was pretty tough. I will say that was the one that probably got my heart going a little bit, but I had to keep my band leader hat on. Nancy Rogers was always a real easygoing chick. And the next day, after we told them the band was changing, she had a call from a female band that needed a drummer immediately. So she grabbed it and she got Pammy in the same band. And by September 29th, they were situated in a new band. So it went very pretty smoothly for such a big thing. Neither girl was mad at us at the onset for wanting to move differently because they got a job so quickly. But Pammy later really did break down. She was pretty heartbroken. She really loved the band and she still stayed friends with us and was supportive. She was writing all these letters to Kathy Perry, our fan club president. You know, I'm not mad. I love those girls. They're so good. I so enjoyed the band. And she went on and on. And then she broke down and had a, you know, some time of crying and stuff. So, and it was hard on her. It was real hard on her.
It must have been hard on you as well. I mean, that even if you were excited about this huge transformation, you're still dealing with people who you'd become friends with and bonded with. And so that is my next question. So you've now let them go. What was going through your mind? I mean, as you said, there was just so much going on. And you, Pat, as the band leader, it's bringing my sister Nancy. Now we're going to get rid of Nancy Rogers and Pammy Benford. And now we're doing these new harder songs. And so much. Tell us about it.
So much. As a band leader, I had to keep a cool head about letting two members go. This is a big deal. And we were raring to go with this new experiment. Susie was going downtown to Motown. She was jamming with the homeboys on drums, just really working it. And Nancy was busy with bass. You know, we were determined to give this experiment a full-on chance to meet a new challenge. This was a huge change with a lot of introspection and possible ideas. But we had nerves about it. Of course we did. We were scared shitless about it. Would it work? How would it be? But as we kept practicing, we could see that it was going to work out. You know, we covered all the angles. And oh my God, we just moved forward. We just did it. We did it, you
You
know?
did it, and you did it phenomenally well, as you always have since the beginning, with whether you're Dare with Dave Leone at the Hideout to
Oh my God.
now completely shaking up the pleasure seekers. And so only 6 days later, after
Yes.
letting Nancy Rogers and Pammy Benford go, the pleasure seekers with the Quattro sisters now
Right.
end up performing on September 13th and 14th, 1969, at the Toledo Pop
Oh.
Festival. And I'm going to read that lineup, somewhat similar, but also
Oh.
amazing. The Turtles, the MC5, Amboy Dukes, Alice, Frost, SRC, Alice Cooper, of course, SRC, The Rationals, Savage Grace, Rush, Fruit of the Loom, Life and the Sisters, PS Set. And so the reason why I'm saying the Pleasure Seekers set list, I want to hear about that, but here is the list you provided me. Try a Little Tenderness, Good Golly, Hanging On, Stagger Lee, Sunshine of Your Love, Piece of My Heart, White Rabbit, I've Been Loving You. And so those were covers. And the originals that you did included Where Have You Gone? Warmonger, which we don't have as of yet. So letting everybody know that. Mr. Power, White Pig Blues, Brain Confusion, and Space Prelude. And so Where Have You Gone? You did a 15-minute long drum solo, and that would be your sister Susie Quattro at this point. You
Right.
did Brain Confusion, which we're going to listen to on the next episode, and which was a jam boogie, which I can only imagine, Warmonger and Tenderness with a percussion break. And so we are going to listen to White Pig Blues as our closing song on this episode, and again, Brain Confusion next. But I want to hear about the other original songs you performed, which we don't have. So what was Warmonger and what was Space Prelude?
Oh God, okay, that's in the rock ether, sorry. I'm sure that had maybe we called our dream opera thing, maybe we gave it that name, or we were writing some song that has just gone from my mind because I don't even remember a song called that. War Mongrel was about the war again. And then we had another one about the war. And we sort of discarded those as we started excelling more in the writing. They became ones that we didn't think as much of. And we couldn't do 15 minute on Where Have You Gone? I'm sure Susie did like a 5 minute. Again, it was a festival. So picture it, we're practicing for a month. So we knew the songs we were going to do very tightly. Okay, so that was the list that we had learned to fill in. Of course, Brain Confusion was one of our absolute favorites. And that's what we did. We just, you know, it was a transitional time between the Quattro sisters and this new incarnation. So we had to do it. We had to perform on this festival and be fucking great.
Of
So
course, you had to be fucking great because you had to
I had
prove
to.
many
Yeah.
points. And
Yes.
so, how was the performance? How were you received? How was it being the Quattro sisters as the pleasure seekers?
It was wonderful. We felt like we pulled it off. It was an incredible festival with that many cool groups. So it was a success, and we were very heartened that we had made the right move. We just very happy with how it turned out, and we had our slot, and the audience loved us. So well done.
Well done, brava. And so just to clarify, at this point, Darlene Arnone, who was your former drummer who quit the band abruptly, that's why you brought Nancy Rogers in before Susie went back on drums. Was Darlene around at all at this point? Did she ever say, I want to come back? What was going on with her?
She was totally involved in her family issues. And I mean, way down the road, or, you know, I don't know how long it took, but she started playing local gigs with a guy that she got with a duo that played several instruments and she was on drums. So that's what she did the rest of her life. That's what happened. When she quit, she wasn't in a big band anymore. It changed her life. And we still were friends, you know, but we were so busy, I didn't really get to talk to her much. I think Pammy talked to her a bit. You know, we all stayed friends. That was the nature of the girl bands in Michigan. You know, we supported each other. It wasn't malice. You know, I had in LA, it wasn't competitive. It was support your female musicians. So that felt good. We were always able to remain friends.
Well, I just have to say quickly that it surprises me about Darlene Arnone because she was such a go-getter on the drums and she so wanted to be in a rock band, but I'm glad to hear she continued to play. And I'm really glad to hear that you've remained friends all these years, especially knowing that in Detroit, there's not the kind of competition there was or is in LA. I love that.
Yeah.
So one gig the Pleasure Seekers did shortly thereafter, and again, now it's just the four Quattro sisters that garnered you as a band a lot of press and a lot of attention. And that was in October 1969, and this was in Montreal, Canada, and it was a huge Coliseum event. And so tell us about this performance as well as the audience response.
Oh, it was amazing. We did a few gigs in October, and Montreal was sort of squeezed in there somewhere. You know, we were traveling around, and it was going very well. And Montreal was like the Pacific Northwest. It was, oh my God, it was so reminiscent of it. We had huge crowds, it was a big event, and we had these girl groupies, hordes of them, just following us everywhere. They were at every performance. We handed out like 60 pairs of drumsticks to the fans and the boys too. I mean, it was a huge event and we were a big draw at that festival. Tons of autographs. They were crowding us, following us. And I speak fluent French, so that helped. You know, I was the interpreter in Montreal. And Arlene was going crazy. I mean, she's dating now. You know, her and Leo are done. And the Montreal guys were so freaking gorgeous. And she was like a kid with a new toy. She met a guy there and she was still dating somebody in Detroit, but she was dating, you know. So she was having a great time and, you know, reliving her 18-year-old life, having married too young. And
I
it was
love it because
amazing.
it's like Arlene was the original boy toy before Madonna.
Oh my God. Oh my God. And then, you know, we played other gigs too, like I said, Minneapolis, Chicago. We did a Missouri Autorama. You know, again, Detroit is the place for car shows, but, you know, every city did their little Autorama type things. And we were a big attraction at that show. It was so fun. So I didn't do photos. I didn't do press. Bad Patty, bad band leader. I was so involved with the band and making sure we were still tight and moving ahead and ready for this challenge that I really put all my attention in the music.
Well, and you can hear it. And I do want to get to this next festival that you played because this is to me, I have so many questions,
Oh
as
my.
do probably more Detroiters than even Mr. Power. As much as they love the song, there are so many people who have questions about this. But before we move on from this Montreal gig, you said that you gave away 60 pairs of drumsticks.
Yes.
Who funded that?
We must have done it. We must have had a storage of them, you know, for festivals and stuff. And we ended up giving all of them out because they just kept, oh, I want some, I want some. Oh, it was hilarious.
That's hilarious. I wonder if anybody still has those. That would be so cool.
No. Jeez. I
Well,
don't.
this festival that's now coming up really has gotten a lot of talk over the decades since it happened. And this was organized and promoted by your brother, Michael Quattro, and he had two others on board with him. I'm going to let you tell the story, Patty, because we are going to clear the record here for the first time since it happened. And so this is October 31st, 1969. So, and this is the Black Arts Festival, and it's in Detroit, and it's at Olympia, which let me just pause here for a second and say, talk about your rock world coming full circle. This is when you were 16 years old, you went to go see this new amazing band called the Beatles at Olympia. And unlike the other screaming girls and guys in the audience, you had your epiphany and founded the Pleasure Seekers. And now, 5 years later, you're performing on a bill that your brother has promoted. So it's the Black Arts Festival at Olympia. And I want you, again, tell us the story because even to this day, you told me your brother still gets worked up over it. And I will laugh because I know talking to you about this, you too still get worked up over it. So tell us.
Oh, it was so controversial because in the middle of this festival, there was politics, the Olympia suits, the press, the bands, so much. It was still an area of some, an era of some racism, issues with the cops and long hair musicians, and the suits not wanting to deal with festivals. And here's the backstory, the best I can tell it, because there's a lot to it. There was a free press lady who wasn't let in. She had trouble at the door or something, and she was already pissed off that that happened. And Mickey was backstage frantically trying to, you know, do all he had to do running the show. Rush Gibb was not involved. His name had been forced on it as one of the promoters by William Morris. We all know who William Morris is. They wanted Rush Gibb's name on it. So he was just there, and it was all left to Mike. And Keener was one of the money guys, Mike Keener.
Mike Keener, okay.
Yes. So, you know, this lady was pissed. She ended up dissing the entire thing and shoving it all on Mike. So the press did quite a hit piece on it. It had been originally contracted on the big colorful poster that everybody, a lot of people have seen, to go till 3 a.m., very early. That was way ahead of the date in the first PR poster. Then the Olympia suit started fucking with it and kept changing it. No, 3 a.m. is too late, and blah, 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 you know, and Mickey had already put out the poster. And then there were additional flyers. He had to keep spending money putting on more posters with different times. They finally settled on noon till 12 a.m. And many of the bands did, in fact, play. Here's where it gets sticky for promoters. Often, politics happen. Nancy knows this. She has run promotion on
Nancy festivals. Quattro, your
Nancy
sister.
Nancy Quattro. She promoted some. She said it's a nightmare. The politics happen. They get a better offer. They say your band isn't going to show. We're not doing it, even though they contracted. And they fuck around with it. And that happened with a couple of the name bands. Nick, the GM of Olympia, told the promoters he'd had enough of the kids and the black arts and black magic, and they could go home at 11 p.m., negating the contract completely that we had until 12. He said, enough of this stuff. You know, he had quite an attitude toward the rock music. And they also denied some of the people, the performers, going on stage. Timothy Leary was there. That press lady bullshitted. He was there. They wouldn't let Timothy go on stage, Mr. Acid Man, you know? So they played these games. They played games with the aisles being clear and kept stopping and starting. And, oh, my God, Mickey was going mad, you know, how they were about the show. So there was no kind of good control prepared. And it was jam-packed, the lines on the street at 12 noon. It was unbelievable how many, and he's still passing out flyers. It's going to go till midnight, not three. So it was crazy. They pulled the plug in the middle of Savage Grace's performance, and then Ted Nugent was supposed to be next, and he was so PO'd, he went ballistic. He went on stage and grabbed the mic, and he riled up the crowd. He was so mad that he couldn't go on. And there was still time left in the show. There was no reason to do that. So, of course, the crowd got riled. There was some damage done. You know, a bit of a rock riot, I would say. And Mike was furious. So this press hit piece came out, which you have, and 10 days later, they printed a complete retraction in the Free Press. And where did they put it? It was like back on page 10 or something. Nobody saw it. Where they revisited the whole Black Arts Festival because it was such a hit piece. And yeah, and then Wayne State Journal later wrote about it as well because we all knew the truth of it. You know, all this shit had happened. Ugh.
Well, you say all of you knew the truth, and of course you do, and that was the truth. And I am going to read this article. The lady's name from the Detroit Free Press was Julie Morris.
Yes.
But my question, though, before I even read it is, the truth really never got out. Is this because the retraction was on the 10th page as opposed to the first page? Because it's, as I said, to this day, people will private message me and ask about the incident at the Black Arts Festival and basically what was up with Michael Quattro, and that basically he's still blamed. He, according to these people, he fucked up. He was an asshole, whatever it was. And at this point, when the Black Arts Festival was, he had already put on multiple successful festivals.
200, yeah.
Right. So he's not a novice here. So why do you think Mickey was blamed? And then I want to read the article.
Well, he was the one that was always in the press. So he was an easy target for this lady. Gibb was at the Grandee, but he didn't really come. He wasn't really out public as much as Mickey. And Keener was a money man way behind the scenes. Mickey was the target. This happens often in industry, you know?
It does.
It's a crash.
And also, well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but also Michael, your brother, being so well known in Detroit, even his face was used in the press to show that he was the one promoting it. Well, so here is the article. And this was written in soon thereafter, the next day or so, of October 31st, 1969. So let's say the next day. She writes, give me 1 second. Olympia Stadium, Halloween night, falsely advertised. Four major rock acts he, meaning Michael Quattro, never had under contract for the event. None of the four acts, she writes, The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, Pink Floyd, Kim Fowley, and the MC5 appeared at the Friday night show that 12,300 persons paid $500 each for the set. The show's promoter, 25-year-old Mike Quattro, advertised Brown, Pink Floyd, and Fowley on 72,000 posters and postcards and on radio commercials. The MC5, a top-drawing Detroit band, was advertised in the radio commercials. Band members said they were taken off the posters and postcards only after repeated insistence. Quattro, who runs Mike Quattro, Inc., and then they give his home address on Mac, a booking agency and advertising and public relations firm, organized the show in partnership with Russ Gibb, a promoter, disc jockey, and owner of the Grand Riviera Ballroom. Gibb financed the affair. Seven other acts that were advertised also did not appear for various reasons. And then she goes on to list them. So this contradicts what you just told us, Patty. She writes they were the Detroit Amboy Dukes. So that's Ted Nugent and the Bob Seger System, the California Group, Alice Cooper, the English Bonzo Dog Band, drug advocate, Dr. Timothy Leary, occultist, Anton Levy, and the Frost of Saginaw. And this, and she goes on to write, and it's really in depth, that the booking that Seger canceled it because he didn't want to be there the week of the festival when Quattro was there. But the other thing that she said, and this may sound petty, but I think it speaks to your point and the fact that your brother had to change so many things so often. She says the festival ended on a sour note when Olympia officials shut off the power in mid-song during the performance of The Savage Grace at 12:52 a.m. without telling the audience that the show was scheduled to end at 1 a.m., not at 3 a.m. as Quattro had advertised. Many members of the audience refused to leave after the power was pulled. Police were called to disperse the crowd, and the stadium was not cleared until about 2:30 a.m. after $1,200 worth of damage was done to stadium equipment. So I'm just curious. I mean, again, even the she's even getting the time wrong of when it was shut down by the Olympia suits.
Yes. So Mike will never forget that. At 11, they pulled the frickin' plug, and he had another, you know, till 12. It was ridiculous. And Timothy was there. They wouldn't let him go on stage. A lot of the bands, Ted was there ready to play. It was totally BS and exaggerated to the hilt. And Olympia had really played a lot of games, as had the booking agents that didn't follow the contract and have a couple of the major bands play because they had a different gig they'd rather do. This goes on with promotions. It really hurt Mickey. He was, you know, he'd been so successful with his festivals, and this was like a real hit piece. So, yeah, it drove us crazy. And then the retraction of being on page 10 or whatever, it might as well have not even been printed, where they corrected a lot of it.
I was just going to add, and again, decades later, people are still worked up over this event and
Sure.
still blame your brother. So I do think it needs to be understood in a much wider context and that it was much more complicated than that. And so even though you had written the song, the Pleasure Seekers had written the song White Pig Blues
Right.
before this event occurred at the Black Arts Festival Halloween night, 1969. This song to me really speaks about the mayhem that was going on at the time, especially across Detroit. It was a city at odds with itself in terms of racism, culture versus counterculture, drugs, the hippie era, the Vietnam War, boycotts, riots, and this chaos, this malaise, if you will, and this heavier, yes, music. So, and if, yes, this was all over the US at the time, but you were in Detroit and you were musically documenting what you were witnessing, Patty, and White Pig Blues was another snapshot of this narrative, ongoing narrative in Detroit. And as you do so beautifully, will you tell us about White Pig Blues? Read the lyrics, tell us what the band's intention was, its origin, and how it does fit into what happened that night on Halloween with the Black Arts Festival at Olympia.
Yeah, it was probably the only blues song that we ever wrote. A lot of Susie put a lot of her feelings in it. I loved how she escalated how the ending went with the guitar, because she got real excitable at the end of it. That's what I want when we listen to it. It's very cool. She just goes to town on it. But it started out sort of about talking about love and her feelings and feeling blue. I'll read a little bit of it. I've got the blues. Yeah, looks like everything I do is gonna lose. Ain't nothing but the bad times, baby, and I can't go on this way. That's one verse. And then, come do that number with me, baby. Yeah, that act that drives me so crazy. Come on and be my strong lover. Yeah, rock those blues away. She was feeling Detroit was gritty. It was a hard city to be in. There was so much in the culture, like you said. And it went back and forth with the cops and the long hair musicians. We felt all that. These are our homeboys. And it was just a very hard city culturally for everybody to get along. And the music was the only thing that brought us together. So this song sort of grabbed that moment, and we felt it was. We were scrappy and gritty, and I had not seen that in other cities. I'm telling you, it's different in Detroit. It's just very different.
Everything I do is gonna lose. make a little change. Wow! Do something, do something, do something! That juice! Peaks, baby. Could use a little pain.